Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wusstest du, dass TK Maxx immer die besten Markendeals hat? Duftkerzen für alle, Sportoutfits, stylische Pieces für dein Zuhause, Designer-Handtasche, check, check, check. Bei TK Maxx findest du große Marken zu unglaublichen Preisen. Psst. Im Onlineshop auf tkmaxx.de kannst du rund um die Uhr die besten Markendeals shoppen. TK Maxx, immer der bessere Deal im Store und online.
Copper Bullets, the four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories, is available now.
Zambia was considered as an underdog.
Are we going to do the impossible here?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're hearing from pilgrims in Saudi Arabia. We'll discuss why so many young people have sexually transmitted infections but can't or won't get treatment.
A young person might be suspecting that they're having an STI, but because of obstacles like shame, discrimination around seeking services in health facilities, even having the money to access these services is still a challenge to young people.
And we'll hear about the Nigerian students who face deportation from the UK as currency hikes pushes tuition fees ever higher. But why do African students want to study at expensive institutions abroad?
You want to go to a university that is highly regarded, and basically it increases your signal, which is important for the labor market. And of course, also where you will be employed, both locally and internationally.
It's Thursday, the 20th of June. First, we go to Saudi Arabia. Nearly 2 million Muslims from around the world have been on pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia over the last few days. In that time, hundreds of them have died. And the first culprit appears to be the weather. Temperatures reached as high as 51 degrees Celsius at the Grand Mosque in Mecca, a key destination of the Hajj. The journey involves many stops along a specified route, as we'll hear in a moment, and with tens of thousands of people following a sometimes arduous path in sweltering temperatures, there have been tragedies before. Stampedes, tent fires, and other accidents have caused hundreds of deaths during Hajj to Saudi Arabia in the past 30 years. Some 240 people reportedly died last year. But weather experts warn that rising temperatures in an arid country like Saudi Arabia present a real danger to the health of pilgrims. Aisha Idris is from Nigeria, and she's been talking about her experience in the extreme heat.
I've been in Mecca for the past 30 days. The weather in Mecca is extremely hot. The reason why people died, because on the Arafat, most of the people climbed the mountain and stayed there for the whole day. And the next day, we have to trek for Jamarat, from Jamarat to Mecca. And when we reached there, the weather there was extremely, extremely hot. It's only the mercy of God have survived it. Because when I was going around, I have to be pouring water on my body before I go for each cycle. And I have to use umbrella. With the umbrella, the weather is still extremely hot. And mostly people were really dehydrated. Before I could finish, I was exhausted. Mostly people, they want to finish on time. So I think at the end of the day, the thing affected most people. That's why we have so many deaths. And when I was coming back from Mecca to Mina, I saw like 13 dead bodies on the road.
I've also been hearing from Mohamed Ali, a pilgrim. It was his first time on the Hajj.
It's a well-laid process that starts off with the pilgrims making the intention for Hajj and then going from one location to the other, performing a number of religious activities until it comes to a conclusion in 5 days. And it involved traveling from one location to the other, sometimes walking because of the logistic challenges. This year, the Saudi Arabia government said more than 1,800,000 people registered for Hajj and attended, and you can imagine how difficult it is sometimes.
I can imagine how
how difficult it must have been, the logistics of it all. But of course, the Saudi Kingdom has been doing this for generations now. What I was wondering is, what do people tell you before you go on the Hajj? How do you prepare yourself internally and externally?
Interestingly, Hajj is managed by the Saudi Arabian government, but it's managed through agencies. So they will take you through seminars. For example, I attended two such seminars. You're told about the religious significance. You're told about the logistical challenges. So mentally, I was prepared for worse than I have seen. The agencies are usually responsible for your stay in Saudi Arabia, for your health and everything that comes across. And the Saudi Arabian government will hold them responsible.
Right. There have been times in the past where there have been stampedes or, you know, different accidents. So you were saying that you are prepared for eventualities like that. This year, hundreds of people are feared dead because of the weather. Were you prepared for that?
Yes. Psychologically, I was prepared for that. And there is little you could do, because you cannot change anything about the weather, but the timing is very important. For example, I remember when it came to the stage where we were throwing the stone on the first day, we had to do it between 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. because we were taking advantage of the situation. I remember the people who went after us had difficult challenges because they could not access the area because of overcrowding. The sun was soaring. The heat was excessive. So you have to plan yourself. Some religious activities will start later in the day, but for those which are starting early enough, you should always be ready and on your feet whenever your agency calls you to take a transport or walk.
Right. Just explain to us the stoning for people who don't understand what is involved in this pilgrimage.
The stoning is part of the Hajj rituals. It's where Muslim pilgrims will stone at least three different walls which have been created. The significance is you are stoning the devil. So you are supposed to throw seven different small stones at three different walls which have been prepared. In 2015, this is where the biggest, deadliest stampede happened. Over 3,000 people died. In my experience right now, this was my first time, I have realized that they have created two different exits and entries. So you go into a hole, you line up, you throw and leave in another different exit. So I think that also has reduced the challenge of a stampede.
So you were saying that these things need to be timed and there are measures taken to allow people to move safely. But of course, if your agency only has a slot late in the afternoon or when the weather is at its height, it's difficult for them to plan it so that people are out of the extreme temperatures. What were the specific measures that were announced by the Saudi authorities, what to do in the extreme heat? Did they warn people about the extreme heat? And are there measures, for instance, is there water available? Are there medics available? Are people advised on what to wear and what to do and what the symptoms are of heat stroke and stuff like that?
With technology, the Hajj is more becoming digital because they have created an app where you can access all the information. I remember when we were at Mina, when we were doing the stoning, we received the messages on our phones. We received the messages on the local telecom companies that we were using that warned the people not to go out between 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. So the whole stoning area was shut down for a whole day until after 4 p.m. They have also made sure that there are water fountains or water taps across the road that we were taking. They also made sure that there were also standby emergency teams. I passed by the third stone throwing area and I could see somebody who was actually taken away. I don't know what the problem was, but I could imagine many people got affected because it was almost midday, past midday. Public information is there. Some areas with billboards. If you access the application, you'll also find information related to the weather.
And yet, hundreds of people may have died because of the heat. I'm wondering, what do you think has been happening? Have they not been able to get this information? Or is it the case that the weather is so extreme that it doesn't matter that they may have been trying to follow all of this?
Absolutely. Not everybody really follows the instructions sometimes. Not everybody is really fit in terms of health. Some are very old. And in some places, it gets very crowded. So probably some of these people who are affected is because of health, because of age. and because of timing.
So you don't think that the extreme weather and the number of people who died this year will put people off doing it?
I don't think so. In highly populated Muslim countries like Indonesia, Pakistan, talking to them when I met them here, they will tell you people go on a kind of a lottery agreement where you're only lucky to go once and then you can only do it after 5 years. So probably I will not be really hesitant if I get the opportunity.
Thank you very much for sharing your experiences with us. And I'm glad that you are safe. Bye-bye. A newly created Al-Haji Muhammad Ali. The World Health Organization says there's a major increase in sexually transmitted infections around the world, but two regions are showing a particularly marked increase, Africa and the Americas. In 2022, countries set a target to reduce the annual number of adults with syphilis infections from 7.1 million people to less than a million by the year 2030. And that is in less than 10 years' time. Yet new syphilis cases among 15 to 49-year-olds have increased by over a million in 2022. Then there were 8 million people. So the 2030 target is looking less and less likely, especially as the young populations of Africa reach sexual maturity.
It is common in this age group. The reason is because most of them are just becoming sexually mature. So they are trying to experiment new things. Most of them have a lot of sexual partners. So because of that, the rate of infection or the prevalence or the incidence of sexually transmitted infections is higher among this age group.
That's Dr. Twamsen Peter Shindes, the Senior Program Officer at the Institute of Human Virology in Nigeria. So let's hear some solutions from two young activists, Gab Clinton in Nigeria and Marlene Atieno in Kenya. Welcome to you both. Thank you very much for speaking to us here on Focus on Africa. How high is awareness of STIs amongst younger people? And I'm talking about people, I suppose, below the age of, let's say, 28.
I will say young people have the information. However, there's still so many obstacles that stop young people from accessing services. And when I say this, I mean like a young person might be suspecting that they're having an STI, but because of obstacles like shame, discrimination around seeking services in health facilities, even having the money to access these services is still a challenge to young people.
In Nigeria, it's two ways, right? One is young people are having difficulty to access comprehensive sexuality education, which is comprehensive SRH education, due to, we know, religious and cultural biases. And as a young advocate working around SRH, sexual reproductive health and rights, we over the time had faced restriction in terms of promoting comprehensive SRH services.
Now, both of you have said that people actually do know what the issues are. They know about STIs. It's just a matter of accessing help with it. So what's the solution? Where do we go in order to help people to overcome the stigma of it? And I want to also ask, are there actually services across the board in the two countries that you come from? Because I know there's often a very serious difference between rural and urban provision of healthcare.
Stigma and discrimination is an issue, right? And also in terms of accessing SIHR services, you need to be 18 plus. But currently in Nigeria, we young youth advocates are coming together to see how we can actually address issues around age and to see if we can actually bring the age down from 18 down to 14. But it's not an easy journey, having to speak to lawmakers, policy people, and that.
And the 14-year-old's parents, I imagine, because I'm not sure that they want 14-year-olds to access health services without their consent or without their knowledge. Would that be what you're advocating?
Yes, yes. And that is just it. And most of them do not really have the finances to be able to afford the services. And so because of that, they are in our country, there are limited NGOs who are providing the services for free. And where they could also get other services, they are to pay.
Paying for services is a barrier that you've also mentioned, Marilyn. Are you also in favor of lowering the age that people can get these services free without the consent of their parents?
So actually in Kenya, our age of consent is 18, but then the parameters around that are really blurred. So it's not actually a conversation that I feel as a country we are ready to have. We've been trying to push for that and that's not the case. And I also think that we have sexualized age-appropriate sexual education so much that parents fear and shy away from talking about that. When you mention about sexual and reproductive health, the first thing that comes to a parent's mind is we are teaching young adults to have sex. So they just look at condom demonstrations and all that, and not really looking at this is age appropriate in a sense that we can't teach a 10-year-old how to wear a condom. So I feel like there is also part of that conversation that is missing out of all this.
So Gab, let's talk about digital health and what solutions it may offer in this situation.
Over the years, we've tend to study that it's easier for we to be able to bring together young people on platforms. And currently, so many NGOs that we work together, there was a time we decided to engage more of young people with other comprehensive sexualist education out of the norms of maybe through the schools or through community gathering and all that. And over the years, we've seen high numbers of people coming to join the platform, right? We're using the WhatsApp platform, and the number keep increasing every day. And the engagement of these young people are on the rise. And they ask so many questions that we are like, oh, wow. So there are so many things that they want to talk about, but because it's an open space, they don't want to talk about it. Now we're using digital space, and now they are talking about it. So at that point, we felt that there was more for we to do than ensuring that there's also services for them using the digital platform, right? And that is what brought about my advocacy around digital health, to ensure that we also bring everything, all our traditional method in accessing service, also bring it within the digital space for young people to be able to access it. But however, it should be a safe space for them so that they could express themselves in a way whereby they could connect to a doctor and then discuss about their issue. They could connect to a therapist, discuss about their issue, access condoms, lubricants, access PrEP, contraceptives, access any other HIV self-test kit, and then it's delivered to them in their safe zone. And as young people for us in Nigeria, we've started that campaign, and we started our movement, and we'll be making big progress, right? That is what we have, Yanga Ninja, where we are using digital space to actually promote HIV self-test kits, which means a young person could access self-test kits using a USSD code just from their small mobile phone. And then we have some organizations who have started using a digital platform as a therapy center, whereby if you need to see a psychologist, you could book an appointment and then have an online engagement with the psychologist. So, and apart from that, again, we've been using the digital health to also for young people to tell their stories about their experience accessing traditional services and also digital services. And then over the years, we've seen the differences that a lot of young people talking about their experience having to visit the facility and also their experience having to use the online platform. And it shows progressing that a lot of young people wants to come on board within the digital health space than the physical space, where they could actually mitigate stigma and discriminations of like mind they might actually face.
Right. So you found a way in which you can help people using new technology. But what I'm wondering is,
yes,
that there are people who don't have access to that technology. And the issue doesn't go away, does it? Where we actually need to have open and clear conversations and meet each other, you know, parents, teachers, policymakers, and young people halfway. Marilyn was talking about that. Marilyn, how do you see that happening? Is it possible for people to meet each other halfway?
Yeah, we should. And I'll just speak a bit. I'm also a digital youth advocate by Nairobits. And that means that we leverage on digital platforms to pass SRHR information and also like points of access to youth-friendly services, which is really important. Now, with Girl Effect, I think they've done quite a lot in integrating how this information and also services are being accessed. I was part of creating a digital solution that would respond to some of these challenges that we are facing. That led to the creation of Wazi. So Wazi is a brand that I was part of creating. And actually, to a surprise, we also came up with a podcast that I also host. So we are trying to pass information to young people in ways that they are most comfortable and they would actually prefer. So the chatbot brings on board experts, that being or BYGN, that being medical doctors, to just speak about issues that relate to us. And actually, a cool factor about also the Wazi chatbot is that you just don't need to have access to the chatbot itself. We also have a USSD. So this works in Migori. Migori is part of a rural setting within Kenya. So it's not just accessed by young people in the urban area, but the integration is cool in a way that even those in the rural areas can actually access the same information information and also get points of services from the same.
If there are parents listening to this now, I want to end our conversation with you two telling me what you think they should be taking on board to address the fact that 13% of HIV deaths in 2022 were people under the age of 15 years. We're talking about people having sex when they're really quite young. You were saying there, Geb, that 13-year-olds were having sex. We're talking about teenage pregnancy. So clearly, people need to talk to each other. And digital platforms are valuable and useful, but this still needs to be people-to-people conversations that we need to have. So I'll start with you, Geb. What do you think? What would you tell a parent now?
So definitely one of the things that I would do is to ensure that we talk about the data and tell them this is the issue that is on ground. And if they don't come on board or actually support what the work is doing, there are a lot of young people who are also going to have the same fate like the data we're currently having. And so to address that issue, it's just a need for them to be able to support the work that we do.
Marlene, what about you?
So I think this should be part of the change that we young people are trying to drive in the sense of understanding that they can't safeguard us online. There's so much they can do, but then linking us to the right information will make us make informed decisions and not go back to the same issues that we keep talking about over and over again.
Okay. Thank you very much to you both. I'm hoping that we make some advances in this regard because we've been talking about these things forever.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Marlene Atieno in Kenya, a gender equality champion and youth panel member at Girl Effect, which is a media nonprofit organization for girls across the globe. And Gab Clinton is a digital health expert in Nigeria. He's also a human rights and gender justice advocate. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Foul, Schwalbe, rote Karte, Videobeweis, Fußballdiskussionen, da hilft die Big Mac Methode. Ja, die Big Mac Methode. Schlichtet schnell, einfach und effektiv jede Debatte. Denn nur beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig. Probieren Sie die Big Mac Methode. Nur bei McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Now to the plight of Nigerian students here in the UK as the cost of a university education spirals beyond affordability for them due to a cash crunch back home. They've been threatened with deportation because they'd failed to pay their university tuition fees. University authorities say they're in breach of the requirements for their student visas. The penalty is deportation. At one university, the affected students were blocked from classes. Another said it would remove IT and library services, as well as withhold qualification certificates. Some universities have since softened their approach by re-enrolling some of the indebted students. Understandably, these students are devastated by the threat of deportation because they won't be allowed back into the country to complete their studies should they catch up on their fees. We've been talking to some of them. They didn't feel safe enough to be recorded, but they did send written testimony, so we've had them read out loud for you to hear. This is Esther, who was given a deportation notice.
I attended all of my classes and seminars. I'm a hell of an active student. It is disheartening. I'm now on antidepressants, and being here alone, I have nobody to talk to. For over 2 months, I have barely eaten or slept, and I don't understand why this is being meted at us. We didn't do anything wrong.
Jude was studying social work and was midway through a placement when he was told his access to the university was suspended and he would have to leave the country.
As of now, I've paid £14,000. And I have a balance of £14,000. I'm willing to come to an agreement as to how I will make this payment, but I need guarantees that I'll be re-enrolled into school and my visa restored.
A spokesperson for the Home Office told the BBC that wherever a visa was shortened or cancelled, individuals should, and I quote, take steps to regularise their stay or make arrangements to leave the United Kingdom. Now, every year, hundreds of thousands of prospective university students across Africa set their sights on expensive foreign institutions to further their education. My colleague, Richard Kagoe, has been speaking to Ramaele Mushweshwe, an education expert and senior lecturer at the National University of Lesotho. He said the appeal is partly due to, this is a direct quote, prestige and signaling.
So basically, you want to go to a university that is highly regarded, and basically it increases your signal, which is important for the labor market. And of course, also where you will be employed, both locally and internationally. The people or the market actually values you more simply because of that signal, on the belief that having gone to a particular university, you actually have gained a little bit more than another person who have gone to university B. The second thing would be the possibility of working and permanently migrating to Europe. We know there is this intrinsic desire for most of the people to, because of lack of job opportunities locally, to also migrate abroad. So basically that increases your chances to also get employed on that side. And last, but also which I consider to be more important, the issue of the quality of education, and is due to several factors. Inadequate funding, which makes it difficult for most higher education institutions in Africa to basically retain human capital and also do relevant and quality scientific research. And then I would say inherent inefficiencies within our higher education system. You find that a PhD student or a master's student registers for what could possibly be regarded as a one-year master's or two-year master's. Let's say it's administratively supposed to be 2 years, then they graduate after 4 years. And that's a waste of time.
It's interesting because part of this appeal is driven by, should I say, like aggressive marketing by Western universities. What role really does that play in terms of generating that interest or appeal among prospective students?
Marketing people, they just package what they offer. You know, sometimes they actually overhype whatever they offer. Even, but because of lack of funding, our African higher education institutions, they're actually not, you know, competing when it comes to marketing themselves. You know, some students may not even know some of the best programs that are offered by some universities locally.
Right. So considering the student flight from Africa, mostly to the West, what impact does this really have in terms of knowledge production on the continent?
There are pros and cons. So on the pros, when you get some, let's say, 100 African students, they go and do top science university in the West. And then those 10 actually come back and actually become part of faculty in some of our local universities. As you can see, they get higher education, a quality education, and then they come and actually develop locally. Some of these, they go, they may actually end up actually working abroad. And with the remittances that they send locally, they actually help fund more education locally. Even if they stay abroad, they will be able to send remittances would actually help to fund education of those who are left behind. On the cons, I think it doesn't help to develop indigenous knowledge system. If you are taught abroad, most of the times you get assimilated into the thinking and scientific thinking, and you push some kind of a frontier in things that are considered more important in the West than those that are considered important in Africa.
One of the challenges that's more prevalent across Africa is lack of funding, especially for institutions of higher learning which are owned by the state. How do you think this can be resolved?
Government has to play a bigger role. We have to direct resources to public universities, public higher education universities. The more they attract local candidates to come and study with them, the more they'll be able to make more money.
All right, Mushweshwe, thank you so much.
Ramaele Mushweshwe, senior lecturer in the Department of Economics at the National University of Lesotho. Now, countries such as the UK, Canada and Australia are among the most popular study destinations. In several African capitals like Nairobi, it is common to see billboards advertising European and American universities. Some application centers even offer candidates free services to get admitted. Richard also spoke to Skeeter Anyesi, who is a recruitment agent at UNICEF Education in Nairobi, which describes itself as the number one education consultancy in East Africa and a one-stop shop for students looking for opportunities abroad.
Skeeter, it's great having you on Focus on Africa podcast. How are you doing?
I'm well.
Over the couple of years that you've been doing this, would you say that there's an increasing demand for African students who are seeking to study abroad?
Yes, there is an increasing demand because you'd find that most students prefer to study abroad, especially because of the opportunities that they get there and also the recognition of the degrees that they get after they complete studying. So many students are now looking into studying abroad to like explore more options and get the exposure that they want.
And which countries specifically would you say really top in terms of preference for students who want to study abroad?
Our major countries would be the UK, we have the US, we have Australia, we have Canada, we have Europe, of course, and then we have other destinations that are like Turkey, Cyprus, Dubai as well. And even the New Zealand.
Where would they really want to go abroad? And yet it's a very, very expensive undertaking. I mean, if you look at the costs to a certain extent, it can be quite prohibitive.
There are expensive countries. And we also have the budget-friendly countries. And apart from that, we normally have some scholarship opportunities that we offer to students.
So how do the students and families really manage the financial burden that's associated with financing, you know, investment?
Most sponsors that want their students to go and study abroad are able to like pool resources. You find that most of them even have like things, assets that they can sell so that they ensure that these students go abroad and get the return, the good return on investment. So the students are guaranteed once they go there, at least they are able to get a good degree and even come back and be able to like even create their own businesses and get the return.
Are there specific fields of study that have become very popular or a lot of people are really interested in?
Definitely, we are moving into the tech era. So everyone wants to do anything that has technology. So you'd find that we send many students who want to study either any of the IT-related programs, be it computer science, be it data science, business analytics, and also the health-related fields.
So do students get any sort of support from your organization once you have facilitated them, you've placed them in a university, they've just reported and they've begun their studies? Or does that really end at the point of admission?
We do help the students from the onset until they get admitted to the school. And even while they are there, we normally just check up on the students. This is because you'd find that different students come from different backgrounds. And even the education system that is offered abroad is different from ours, or rather the local that they are used to.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Why is, you know, the way you do advertising so intense? What else do you do, like some of the activities?
Our major one is definitely the fair. However, we do have school visits as well, because we have to get to the students that are keen on like going abroad. So we have to visit them at their schools. And also with the fair, normally it's for the public, the general public. So we are able to get those people who are interested in studying from the different age groups.
What's the future of international education for African students? Are we likely to see more and more students go abroad, or at some point we're going to see sort of like a decline?
What I'm seeing is that this will definitely go on the rise. Students will definitely want to go abroad and study. So the exposure that is there and also the specializations that students are able to get at an affordable cost will definitely give it a rise in terms of students pursuing their studies abroad as opposed to studying here locally.
All right. Thank you, Skeeter. Really appreciate that.
Thank you as well.
Skeeter Anyesi from the education consultancy UNICEF Education, and he was talking to Richard Kagwe in Nairobi. Focus on Africa was put together by Susan Gashui in Nairobi and Patricia Whitehorn, Nyasha Michelle and Bella Hassan here in London. Paul Bachibinga steered as the senior journalist in charge. Technical producer was new dad to Cameron, Jack Graysmark. Alice Muthengi and Andre Lombard are our editors. Do check out our sister podcast, Africa Daily. In the next episode, they are looking at the alleged coup plotters who are in court in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'm Audrey Brown. Stay well. Until next time.